We've been hearing a lot about billions lately. Now for another kind of currency, coupons. Americans redeem about $3 billion worth of coupons every year, and that figure rises when the economy falters. Until a few months ago, Erin Gifford, who's a mother of three, a working mother of three, just dabbled in coupons when she went grocery shopping. Then she got serious and cut her food bill in half. Gifford schooled NPR's Yuki Noguchi on how to save a buck or several thousand.
As far as Erin Gifford's concerned, paying full price for anything is for suckers.
Toothpaste is one I'm telling you. You should never actually pay for toothpaste. I always get free toothpaste using coupons. Jell-O, again, I got this for free because...
We're sitting on our sofa in Ashburn, Virginia, going through about 100 items she recently got free with coupons. Bic pens, French's mustard, Windex, Pastaroni. While most shoppers groan over their food bills, Gifford has made a sport of saving.
And once I got really into that, it just felt more like a game. And it was just exciting to be able to figure out where I could get the best deals using the coupons and when they double, and even getting a lot of stuff for free.
She now saves $500 a month. She says it's key to have a strategy, which means layering on the savings. So as an example, here's an ideal scenario. Let's say a store is running a special on tinfoil. On top of that, you have a coupon, which the store then doubles. Jackpot. Gifford loves recounting tales of conquest like this.
So I had 20 75-cent off coupons, which double at Harris Teeter. So I was getting $1.50 off every $1 toothbrush. So basically, I was getting 50 cents back for every toothbrush I bought. The cashier just could not believe it. She said, "I can't believe it. You saved over $30. I said, "That's right, coupons."
Gifford is a font of money-saving tips. She says shop Sundays when sales usually start so that items don't sell out. Also, to save time, sort coupons by store. And check blogs like couponmom.com or moneysavingmom.com or her own couponcravings.com. Matthew Tilley is with CMS Research. He says when the going gets tough, the tough starts shopping with coupons.
And it's almost eerie and surprising how much it corresponds between that increase in unemployment and the increase in coupon use.
And so after years of declines, last year, coupons started holding steady. Erin Gifford is proud of her system. She sorts newspaper inserts in folders labeled by week.
And then to kind of fill in whenever I'm putting my grocery list together, I'll go online to coupons.com, to smartsource.com. These are great websites that offer printable coupons.
But beware, serious couponing will change how you shop. You'll buy things by the dozen because of some killer deal, and you'll become like your own Walmart, creating an inventory of things that require storage. Gifford uses her basement.
I've got a lot of ketchup right now because ketchup was on sale over the summer.
So you have 8 bottles of ketchup here?
Exactly. 8 bottles. Actually, I think I've got
8 bottles
of
36-ounce ketchup.
Yeah. Right. And like I said, I used to get this like the 64-ounce size. But, you know, by ounce, it was actually cheaper when this was on sale.
At this point, I'm starting to realize just how much money I've been throwing away. And apparently, missing out on all kinds of excitement.
Definitely. The thrill is getting it for so cheap. The thrill is, you know, this box of Fruity Cheerios, everyday price is $3.49. And to be able to get it for 25 cents, that's amazing.
Well, okay. If it's so amazing, I need to see the mistress of coupons in action. Gifford puts her game face on, starts the car, and we're off to Walgreens. First, she grabs a basket and a flyer about this week's sale. Matching her coupons against items on the flyer, she grabs 3 cans of Gillette shave gel and 3 bottles of Pantene hair products. Visine eye drops are $1 more than anticipated, which is a small setback. Then she gets Excedrin migraine, not because she gets migraines, but because she has a coupon for it. And then we come to the Crest ProHealth toothpaste.
This is $2.99, and then I have a $1 off coupon, so I'll pay $1.99. But then it has a rebate, so I'll get back $2.99. So I'll get the toothpaste for free, and then I'll get $1 back.
She considers, then shelves, the dish detergent. There's a better deal at CVS tomorrow. And then we belly up to checkout.
$1 off the Crest, $2 off.
And now, a moment of truth. The total comes to $30.88. But after scanning the coupons, that's $12.38 before an additional $10 in rebates.
So all of that for $2.38. It's good stuff.
Erin Gifford estimates she'll save $6,000 this year, more than enough to pay for the family's vacation to Disney World. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News. Washington.
They're fierce political opponents, but John McCain and Barack Obama do agree on a literary matter. Each man has picked Ernest Hemingway's novel For Whom the Bell Tolls as a favorite, inspirational even. The book tells the story of Robert Jordan, an American who hides out in caves during the Spanish Civil War, fighting the fascists. As part of In Character, our series about famous fictional personalities, NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg takes a close look at Robert Jordan and why he might appeal to both candidates.
The hero of For Whom the Bell Tolls is a man of honor with the passion to fight for a cause he believes in.
I was thrilled by him. Robert Jordan was everything I ever wanted to be.
John McCain recorded on a book tour in 2002. He had just written about Jordan in his memoir, Worth the Fighting For. This past July, for Rolling Stone magazine, Barack Obama listed For Whom the Bell Tolls among the books that most inspired him. So late in this campaign season, we were unable to interview Senator Obama about books. So, two very different men finding the same man's story inspirational. Surprising?
Both these men, in their way, are tough guys. And I think that their code is probably inherent in Robert Jordan. Robert Jordan is really a great and admirable character.
War novelist Robert Stone.
Above all, stoicism, grace under pressure, the 20th century heroism. In fact, Hemingway kind of created the whole idea of the anti-fascist hero. I mean, you can't really have Casablanca and Humphrey Bogart and all those characters without the Hemingway character. They all kind of derive from Robert Jordan.
Scholar Gail Sinclair says Robert Jordan embodies what's called the Hemingway code.
The idea that we only have this world and that there probably isn't God or a world after this one. So you have to establish for yourself a code of behavior.
Manly, honorable, Jordan is an idealistic stranger in a foreign land.
Tell us, English, why have you come so far to fight for our republic?
Gary Cooper played Robert Jordan in the 1943 film version of Hemingway's book.
A man fights for what he believes in, Fernando.
His own country.
Well, maybe you feel that I'm sticking my nose into other people's business, but I don't feel that way. It's not only Spain fighting here, is it? It's Germany and Italy on one side and Russia on the other, and the Spanish people right in the middle of it all.
Jordan's job is to blow up a bridge. It's a bad order, and he knows it. Yet he carries out his mission, protecting the small band of fighters who've been helping him in the snow-covered mountains. He sacrifices himself for their cause.
You know, I think back on what Barack Obama had said about his mother saying, you must live so that you make a difference in the world.
Robert Jordan tries to do that. Jordan is a bright young American who leaves his comfortable teaching job in Missoula, Montana, to hide in caves with the partisans.
They are a ragtag group of guerrillas. They are farmers. They are gypsies. They are people who are disenfranchised from the larger society. So Jordan takes up the cause for those who are less fortunate, but not less passionate.
Barack Obama, Sinclair points out, is also a bright young American who chose a life of public service over a well-paid law firm job.
That's pretty good.
Novelist Robert Stone imagines another quality Obama might admire in Robert Jordan.
The kind of toughness that, as a black person in America, has to be summoned. You know, when there are so many traps, intentional and unintentional, to undermine somebody's respect and self-respect. And I can imagine that you have to be really tough to be as successful and as eloquent and persuasive as Obama is.
Robert Jordan is tough, principled, heroic, and doomed. Yet he carries out his assignment. In that 2002 interview on WBUR's The Connection, John McCain said he thought about Hemingway's hero over and over again as a prisoner in Vietnam.
I knew that Robert Jordan, if he were in the next cell to mine, he would be stoic, he would be strong, he would be tough, he wouldn't give up, and Robert would expect me to do the same thing.
At the end of For Whom the Bell Tolls, Robert Jordan is in a forest looking down at the bridge he was sent to destroy. His leg is broken. He tells his young lover, Maria, Ingrid Bergman in the film. When they make love, the earth moves. He tells Maria she must go on without him.
You go now, Maria.
No, no, I stay with you, Roberto.
No, Maria. What I do now, I do alone. I couldn't do it if you were here. No. If you go, then I go too. Don't you see how it is?
And then, alone, lying there on the pine needles, Robert Jordan faces his death.
He knows that life is good and that it's going to be a bad thing to lose his life, but he's very stoic about it, as Hemingway characters always are. He ends with a phrase that I know McCain has quoted before, and it's a very powerful one. The world is a fine place and worth the fighting for.
And I will very much hate to leave it. It's a beautiful phrase when you think about it. And to me, it means everything. Maximize your time. Care about the world, not just your own self. And accept your fate. Accept your fate.
Now fate has given John McCain and his presidential opponent, Barack Obama, the chance to make history. Their fight schooled, in part, on a fictional character they both admire, Robert Jordan, the hero of For Whom the Bell Tolls. Ernest Hemingway took his title from a meditation by Renaissance poet John Donne. Writing about the interconnectedness of humanity, the poet observes, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main." And Donne's meditation continues, "Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
You can read the first chapter of For Whom the Bell Tolls and watch clips of Gary Cooper in the 1943 film adaptation of Hemingway's novel on our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. It's an idea so entrenched in our culture in America that we learn it as small children. First comes love, then comes marriage. Yet in some places, it's the other way around. Bride and groom may barely know each other as they begin life with a spouse chosen by their parents. For Muslims in the U.S., those deep traditions often clash with a younger generation's desire for freedom. Today, we begin a series on Muslims and arranged marriages with this profile of a young woman's conflict between her own wishes for the future and those of her parents. Here's NPR's Jamie Terabay.
Sitting in an internet cafe, texting away on her phone, is Madiha Sandhu. She's 25, and you'd think she has all the time in the world, but her parents do not. To them, her clock is ticking. She's still single, and her whole family is freaking out.
Everyone is, like, obsessed with me. Ever since I got back from Pakistan, they were like, "Oh, why didn't you get her married?" And I'm like, "I didn't want to get married." And they're like, "What's wrong with you? Okay, leave her here, and we'll talk some sense into her."
She looks like your typical modern Muslim girl. She's in jeans and high heels. Her dark eyes are lined with makeup. But she's also wearing a veil. And that, she says, makes her seem too conservative to the men her parents have tried to marry her off to.
They think I'm old-fashioned. That was another thing they didn't like, was because I covered my head. And they were like, "Is she religious?" They don't want someone who's religious. And they want someone who's modern.
They are not men here in Bayonne, New Jersey. They're back in Pakistan, a country she left when she was 5 years old. Her parents still travel there regularly, hoping to find her a match. But living in the States all this time has made Sandhu feel more connected with her religion than her native culture. And she feels more American, too.
Pakistan is just too different. It's like very, it's like having my arms, like, being taken off or something. There's very little for a girl to do but stay home and cook and clean.
Still, her parents want her to marry someone from the old country. So you're listening and thinking, she's 25, all grown up, all American. Why doesn't she just leave home? Sandhu is like so many young Muslims. Their parents have come from overseas to start a new life here while keeping traditions they left behind. She loves and respects her parents and wants to be a good Muslim, so she goes along with their wishes to a point. she feels trapped between the two cultures.
I don't have a problem with arranged marriages, you know, where one's parents picks out the spouse for their kid.
Earlier this year, Sandhu put together an animated film. She called it Arranged and entered it in a competition. In this scene, she describes how a young bride has to keep looking down during the wedding ceremony. It's meant to show she's sad to leave her family, but the groom can look wherever he wants.
Have you seen the guy? Makeupless? Yeah, he looks his age. Exactly about 10 years older than her. Do you see him? Yeah? Well, she doesn't. She won't see him until she's allowed to look up. She has yet to see him, ladies and gentlemen. This is an arranged marriage.
Sandhu won the competition, but then her parents saw the video and scenes like this one upset them.
They still want twig skinny girls in their teens with a college education not to work, but to be housewives and have many, many kids, preferably sons. She must have a great figure that, of course, now is covered because he married her, and he's insecure and possessive, and she must be obedient and not argue.
And my dad was like, oh, I can't believe she said all that stuff. And I'm like, well, it's the truth.
I asked to talk to Madiha Sandhu's parents, but she said they would refuse. For many families like Sandhu's, a marriage arranged by the parents is the best way they know to guarantee a solid future for their child. Khalid Latif is Sandhu's local spiritual advisor. He does a lot of premarital counselling for young Muslims. He understands where parents like Sandhu's are coming from.
When you have something that you've been accustomed to and it's worked for you in a certain way, and your parents told you that's the way it gets done, and their parents told you that's the way it gets done, you know, how can I go against tradition?
In some cases, the two families are related, so they share similar traditions. That, they believe, makes the couple try harder to make the marriage work. Imam Latif says most of the arranged marriages he's seen have been successful, much more so than other marriages, because of the parents' involvement.
You would see that, you know, families would go very much in detail to see, you know, what kind of person is it that, you know, I'm going to be giving my daughter to or even giving my son to.
When Madiha Sandhu meets the men her parents want to give her to, she has to grit her teeth. The men in Pakistan tell her she isn't up to scratch.
First, like, there's a lot of criteria they ask for, especially, like, Pakistani men. They want someone who's fair, which means, like, white. So the whiter you are, the better.
Sandhu has olive skin.
So then they wanted someone who was skinny. They want skinny girls. When people would see me, they were like, oh, she's healthy, which means fat.
But you're not fat, let's just be clear.
Yeah.
She laughs it off. But when her parents agree with the criticism, that hurts.
Because, you know, they'll be like, oh, this is wrong with you, this is wrong with you. And then, you know, you have your parents agreeing. They're like, this is what they want. You don't fit it. And, you know, thus you have to fix yourself or, you know, no one's going to want you.
She doesn't write the whole arranged marriage thing off completely. In fact, she thinks it helps to enter marriage with a clear-eyed realism she thinks other people miss when they're head over heels in love. Her biggest fear is she'll be forced to live in Pakistan and give up her art, her drawing. Some of the men she's met have told her they think it's against Islam. It isn't.
There's a lot of people that are like, if you get married, I don't want you to draw. And so I'm like, I don't know about that. I don't think I can do that.
For now, she's stuck at home. She's only got one semester of her fine arts degree to go, but it's been continually postponed because of her parents' mission to see her married.
Every time I tried to start, my parents sent me away. So it's like, I've been 2 years bumming around. And I'm like, oh, great. My classes are never going to end. I'm never going to graduate.
Even though her parents are on the verge of taking her overseas again, she signed up for classes and hopes to finish. Ultimately, she wants to work as a digital artist. She hopes whoever her parents have in mind for her will be okay with that. But she also hopes the marriage is years away. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
Tomorrow in our series, a singles event for Muslims with one key rule, no parents allowed.
I have never been married before, but I would guess I would help out. In a marriage, if we had the same background, being raised in the States.
So someone who understands the popular things that you do.
Yeah, kind exactly.
Of quote Seinfeld back at you.
There you go, right. It's pop culture, right.
both U.S. presidential candidates had formative experiences in Southeast Asia four decades ago. John McCain's plane was shot down in Vietnam during the war, and he spent more than 5 years as a prisoner. Last month, Morning Edition reported on how the U.S. campaign is playing in Vietnam. Turns out McCain has many admirers there. This morning, we visit Indonesia, where Barack Obama went to elementary school. Among many Indonesians, America's image has been tarnished by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But as NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Jakarta, Indonesians have a soft spot for Obama.
Adang, just one name, is a little tired of reporters coming to his school in Mentang, expecting an Islamic boarding school and evidence of Barack Obama's secret Muslim identity, an image encouraged by some of Obama's political opponents in the U.S. Not true, the security guard says, as he leads me through the halls to the courtyard of the school.
Yang gak boleh dipugar, jadi dibuat sejarah.
He points to Obama's third and fourth grade classrooms and says, patiently, that this is not an Islamic school. Yes, we have a mosque, he says, but at prayer time there are rooms for Christians and Buddhists to pray in too. Public school number one Mentang is actually among the city's finest, in one of Jakarta's most exclusive neighborhoods, home to many of Indonesia's business and political elite. Adang says he wants Obama to win next month simply because he's an alum. It would be good for the school's image, he says, if we can say that the President of the United States studied here too. About a mile away, a more nuanced perspective from an unlikely source. A shopkeeper who lives literally on the wrong side of the tracks, in the shadows of the gleaming new malls and high-rise condominiums sprouting here like mushrooms. In his memoir, Barack Obama writes about his mother's despair at the level of poverty here nearly 40 years ago. Shopkeeper Prabowo says the gap between rich and poor still exists. If anything, he says, it's getting worse. Prabowo says he's been following the U.S. presidential race closely on TV and in the newspaper. The U.S. is a great superpower, and U.S. policy is felt throughout the world, Prabowo says. I like Barack Obama not because he lived in Jakarta, but because I believe he can help change America's image, especially in the Muslim world. If John McCain becomes president, Prabowo says, I don't see things improving in Iraq or elsewhere. But Obama says he'll stop the war, and that, the shopkeeper says, will be a good thing for everyone. Prabowo is Muslim, but says he doesn't care that Obama is Christian. Religion isn't relevant, he says. What matters is how Obama looks at the world and his ability to shape America's foreign policy for the better. But for others, religion does matter. Habib Muksin chairs the advisory board of the Islamic Defenders Front, the self-appointed morality police, whose attacks on bars, restaurants, and minority groups smacks of Afghanistan's Taliban and their ministry of vice and virtue. Habib Muksin doesn't care much for George Bush, has no opinion about John McCain, but believes Barack Obama may do better by Muslims worldwide for having had a Muslim father and living for a time in a Muslim culture.
Barack Obama Kristennya adalah Kristen yang liberal.
He may be a Christian, but he's not a fundamentalist Christian like George Bush, Muksin says. And hopefully Obama can make U.S. foreign policy a bit softer. He's a non-believer, yes, but that doesn't mean we should be suspicious of him. And I believe his time spent here, Muksin says, will help him understand Muslims better than his opponent. Back in affluent Mentang, not far from Obama's former school, Rizal Marangyang is hoping for an Obama win, too. Rizal is 43 and is also running for president in Indonesia next April. He says he's got nothing against John McCain, but in Obama, he sees a kindred spirit.
It will be positive for me and for younger generation in Indonesia. It will not make us win the election, but it will create some kind of opening momentum. Small momentum perhaps, but it will be useful. We say, hey, guys, we also need change here. We also need new blood here. We also need new spirit here. So it's useful for us.
New blood is good, he says, both in well-established democracies like America's and in newly established democracies like Indonesia's too. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Jakarta.
And if you'd like to hear Michael's other report on John McCain in Vietnam, go to npr.org.
Who could have seen this financial disaster coming? Who? Well, Nouriel Roubini, for one. He is a Turkish-born, Harvard-trained, now American economist. He's been a senior financial policymaker for the government. He now teaches at New York University and manages a financial consulting firm. It's Roubini Global Economics, and he blogs in his free time. Professor, welcome to Day to Day.
Pleasure being with you today.
What about the news of today that the U.S. government is going to spend up to $250 billion to buy equity positions in banks?
This is a step in the right direction. The original legislation was passed by Congress was severely flawed because for the government to buy toxic assets was not enough. Most of these banks are severely undercapitalized, and until they would get capital, they would not be able to lend to households and to firms. Therefore, it's a key important step in the direction of resolving this very severe financial crisis. Effectively means a partial temporary nationalization of part of the financial system, but there is no other alternative.
When you say these are temporary nationalizations, Professor, when would this end?
It depends. You know, the banks have had the option after 3 years to buy back essentially these preferred shares. So if the financial conditions are going to improve, there'll be an option of reprivatizing the public share in the banking system. Of course, if things don't improve, then this government ownership of part of the banking system might continue over time and actually might become larger.
If things don't get better in 3 years?
We have to see. You know, banks might need more than the amount of capital that the government is inputting right now. So even earlier than that, there may be another round of recapitalization of those financial institutions. This is not just a subprime problem. It's subprime, it's near prime, it's prime, it's home equity loans, it's commercial real estate, it's credit cards, it's auto loans, it's student loans, it's leverage loans, it's commercial loans, it's corporate bonds. All these things are going to pile up in a severe recession. So talking about a subprime mortgage problem is an understatement. This is a subprime financial system. So this might be just the first round of several rounds of recapitalization by the government of the financial system.
You're a thoroughly trained economist. If the government is buying parts of the banks, what kind of capitalist world are we living in?
Unfortunately, in the last few years, we had this kind of a laissez-faire approach to financial market regulation supervision that has led to this severe financial crisis, and now we're going to the other extreme of very, very severe government intervention in financial markets and the economy. But in the short run, there is no alternative. Usually, central banks are known to be the lenders of last resort, but at this point, the central banks have become the lenders of first and only resort because no one is lending to the banks, no one is lending to non-bank financial institutions, no one is lending to the corporate sector, and therefore, for the time being, we need this government intervention as a way to prevent a severe financial crisis and a severe economic recession.
This is one step that you laid out last week in a piece that you posted on your blog and at your Monitor site, saying we need to avoid a complete financial worldwide collapse. You laid out several points. What else remains to be done? What does the government need to do?
There are several other things that are missing, even if they're going in the right direction, and many of my recommendations now are being adopted. The first one is that at this point, demand is falling sharply, aggregate demand, and that's going to make this recession more severe. Consumption is falling, residential investment is falling, and if the private sector for the time being is nervous and not going to spend, then the government has to spend more money to boost demand and try to minimize the severity of this economic recession. I propose a fiscal package of the order of $300 billion, infrastructures, grants to state and local governments, unemployment benefits, maybe a small tax rebate for the very poor that's going to try to boost demand directly and indirectly.
It sounds almost like the New Deal back in the 30s. Is that what you're talking about, kind of the Civilian Conservation Corps and roads projects, that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, our infrastructure in the U.S. is totally crumbling. We have to invest in roads, in ports, in bridges.
Okay.
And we have to do that. That's necessary.
Okay, and then the second thing?
And the second thing is that the bad loans of the banks are the heavy debt burden of the households, mortgages, credit cards, student loans, auto loans, and the fraction of the household sector is insolvent, and they're not going to start spending it again until you reduce the debt burden. During the Great Depression, we created this homeowners loan corporation. The government bought the mortgages, reduced the face value, converted them into fixed-rate mortgages of long-term maturity, and we've avoided tsunami foreclosures. We need the same thing this time around.
2 years ago, at a big international finance meeting, you got up and said the train is going to jump the tracks, and you were almost spot on what was going to happen over the next couple of years. After that meeting, people went around saying, well, his math is no good. He doesn't really know what he's talking about. Now you're kind of vindicated, I guess, but how good could you feel about that?
I don't feel good in the sense that right now we have a severe economic recession, we have a severe financial crisis and a banking crisis. But unfortunately, I was right in my assessment. This is going to be a very severe crisis. At that time, there was too much optimism. There was no recognition of the bubble that we had in housing, in the economy, in credit markets. And that was part of the problem.
The markets are back up globally and in the U.S. Is this good? Is this a sign or just another lash of the whip?
I think that we're not yet at the bottom. Of course, the radical actions taken the last few days by the policymakers avoided a total systemic meltdown. That was what was going on last week. But I think that the macroeconomic news and the financial news in the next few weeks and months are going to be negative. People will be surprised on how severe the economic recession is, on how many other financial institutions are in trouble. The fact that it's not just the U.S. as a recession, but now Europe, other advanced economies and emerging market. So unless we fix also the real economy with debt relief, with fiscal stimulus, whatever we do to clean up the bank is not going to be enough, because 6 months from now, the real economy might be tanking so much that there's going to be another round of negative effects on financial markets and financial institutions.
We're in the midst, really, toward the end of a presidential campaign. Both campaigns are coming out offering economic ideas, what they might do. They're responding to the news and also trying to look ahead. Have you had a chance to look at the ideas being offered by Senators Obama and McCain, and do you have any thoughts on them?
Both candidates are coming with ideas. In my view, Senator Obama has been much more aggressive with a more comprehensive plan. Originally, the approach of McCain was the market is going to take care of this thing. And when you have a severe financial crisis, of course, you need intelligent government intervention that is appropriate. So Senator McCain is now trying to catch up with the fact that he underestimated the severity of the economic and the financial problems. Whoever is going to be elected is going to be a very tough time for the U.S. economy and for financial markets. So it's important to aggressively to do things from the first day. We cannot wait for several months until what needs to be done needs to be done. For example, a fiscal package should be passed before the election. We're going to pass it after the election. It may be too late. We need to boost demand right now that is sharply falling. It's going to make the recession more severe. So the time to act is now, not 3 months from now.
Nordell Rubini, he's an economics professor at New York University and the manager of Rubini Global Economics. Professor, thank you.
Pleasure being with you today.
Finally this hour, music that spans continents. The singer who goes by her first name, Chiwaniso, is a rising star in Zimbabwe. She was born in the United States, but when she was 15, she moved to Africa. Chiwaniso's new CD, called Rebel Woman, shows off that mixed cultural background. And our reviewer, Banning Air, says it's one of the year's best African releases.
Chiwaniso grew up to a soundtrack of Stevie Wonder, The Rolling Stones, Aretha Franklin, and even Mozart. But her ethnomusicologist father made sure the songs of their forebears, Zimbabwe's Shona ethnic majority, were also in the mix. As her own talent emerged, Chiwaniso chose to make African music her focus. But when she unleashes her fabulous voice on a Shona melody today, she brings an assertiveness and style that no other female singer in Zimbabwe can match. The
The iron-pronged mbira, heard in all these songs, is believed to call the spirits of ancestors in Shona religion. It's the sort of unique element that has long distinguished Zimbabwe's popular music. What distinguishes Chiwaniso is her confidence in borrowing from other genres, especially American ones. Listen to the pumping, jazzy brasswork and vocal scatting on this song, Gomo. Chiwaniso's confidence extends to her lyrics as well. She experienced Zimbabwe's recent economic and political decline up close. On Rebel Woman, she stands up for children, the poor, and a common-sense approach to development. She once sang in support of Zimbabwe's controversial land redistribution policy. She still backs its ideals today. But in the song Kurima, Chiwaniso laments that the seized land was given to political cronies rather than farmers. Understated but deeply felt, Kurima gets to the heart of things, both thematically and musically. For all the cross-cultural currents in her music, Chiwaniso maintains a distinctly personal style and outlook, and Rebel Woman establishes her as one of the most compelling young voices in today's African music.
Banning Air is senior editor at Afropop.org. He reviewed the album Rebel Woman by Zimbabwean singer Chiwaniso. You can hear her song, Kurima, at nprmusic.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.